And one thing that he wants is he wants his 4-year-old daughter that he had with Nicole to have his last name. Will he get his request granted? I'll keep you posted. This is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, John Russell, and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Pete Musto.
The United States, Japan, and France are urging their businesses to depend less on China to make smartphones, drugs, and many other products. But few companies appear to want to leave China's skilled workforce and suppliers of unprocessed materials to move to other countries. Too much dependence on China leaves global companies open to costly problems during major world crises. The spread of the new coronavirus is one example. Also, the U.S. and China have been locked in a trade war for several years. Both countries have raised taxes on the goods they exchange. Drug makers are one group that is trying to reduce dependence on Chinese suppliers. The industry is establishing sources of unprocessed materials in the U.S. and Europe. But the medical device, consumer electronics, and other industries are continuing to depend on China. Harley Sayedin is the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in South China. He told the Associated Press, "I don't know of a single company right now that is moving ahead with any plans to move." China's rise as the world's low-cost factory has helped to lower costs for consumers and increased many companies' profits. But it has fueled political tension over lost American and European manufacturing jobs. Governments and industry experts worry dependence on China can be a threat to supply chains and national security. Chinese factories put together most of the world's smartphones and consumer electronics. They produce a growing share of medical equipment, industrial robots, and other high-technology goods. The country also is a leading supplier of vitamin C and ingredients for antibiotics and other medicines. The ruling Communist Party has spent 20 years building ports, train stations, communication networks, and other systems. China still offers an unparalleled supply chain for any industry, said Jit Lim of Alvarez and Marsal, a business advising service. Philip Richardson manufactures sound equipment in Panyu, near Hong Kong. He said he has considered Vietnam and other countries, but he said while worker pay there might be 40% lower, the savings will be used up by the cost of losing his network of Chinese suppliers. "We gave it consideration for about a minute, and it doesn't make sense," said Richardson, who has worked in China for 22 years. In Japan, the government considers China a direct competitor. So Japan is offering $2 billion to companies that move production to the country in a virus aid program announced in April. It has also offered $220 million to Japanese companies in China if they move to other countries. The U.S.-China trade dispute has created concern about China's leading position as a supplier of active pharmaceutical ingredients, or APIs. These are the substances used to make drugs and vitamins. Some American experts warn China might withhold APIs. In May, the U.S. government gave a contract worth up to $812 million over 10 years to the Flow Corporation. The Virginia-based company is working to protect against drug shortages by producing necessary ingredients. Drug maker Sanofi is also creating an API supplier to reduce dependence on China. Sanofi said the company will be the second biggest global producer, with yearly sales of over $1 billion by 2022. India and Indonesia also have announced plans to increase their own production of unprocessed drug ingredients. But Sakshi Sika of the market research company Fitch Solutions said those changes are politically driven and will increase costs. China's position as a top supplier, he said, is unlikely to change soon. I'm Pete Musto.
A recent study of coronavirus infections in Italy found that around 40% of cases showed no signs of infection or symptoms. The findings suggest that asymptomatic cases are important in the spread of the virus. The study was led by scientists at Italy's Padua University and Imperial College London. The scientists looked at the Italian town of Vaud. The town has about 3,200 people. It was put under quarantine for 14 days after having Italy's first COVID-19 death on February 21st. An early, unedited version of the study was published in the scientific journal Nature on Monday. The scientists said they tested 85.9% and 71.5% of the population of Vaud at two different times. In the first part of the study, which was done around the time the town's quarantine started, researchers found 73 people were infected. That is about 2.6% of the population. In the second part of the study, which was done after the end of the quarantine, they found 29 people were infected. That is about 1.2% of the population. In both parts of the study, about 40% of those who were infected did not have symptoms at the time of testing. They also did not develop symptoms afterwards. In other words, they were asymptomatic. The study produced evidence that testing, along with case isolation and community quarantines, can stop local outbreaks quickly. Because all of the coronavirus cases found were quarantined, the researchers said, the disease was not able to spread quickly. Andrea Crisanti is a professor at Padua. Crisanti was one of the leaders of the project. Despite silent and widespread transmission, the disease can be controlled, Crisanti said. Testing of all citizens, whether or not they have symptoms, provides a way to prevent outbreaks getting out of hand. Crisanti has become well known in Italy for his support of widespread testing. Crisanti said the success of Vo's testing also guided wider public health policy in the Veneto region, where it had a tremendous impact on the course of the epidemic there compared to other regions. I'm John Russell.
The other day, I started crossing a busy street in Washington, D.C. while looking at my phone. Suddenly, I heard a man shout, "Watch out!" He was telling me about an oncoming car. I did not know that the crossing light was red. The words "watch out" made me quickly return to the sidewalk. I learned something that day. Phones can be distracting. And I remembered how useful warnings are. To warn someone means to tell the person about possible danger or trouble. In English, there are several ways to do this. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will talk about warning phrases Americans use in different situations. Some warnings are urgent and immediate. Others are a form of direct or indirect advice, often about what not to do. Let's talk first about warnings of immediate danger. When warning someone of danger, you can say, "Watch out," just like the man said to me on the street. You can also say, "Look out," or "Be careful." For example, it could be that a moving vehicle or large animal is near. Or you might want to tell someone quickly that they will fall or crash into something or someone. Or you see a heavy object is going to drop or hit someone. Listen to these warnings.
"Look out for that tree."
"Watch out, there's a car coming."
"Be careful, the floor is wet."
Americans often say "careful" instead of "be careful." Short, quick warnings of danger can be very effective. Note also that we sometimes use "careful" or "be careful" in situations that are not urgent. For instance, if someone touches a valuable item and you want them to do it carefully, you can say, "Please be careful." Or if someone you know plans to walk around alone at night, you can tell them to be careful. Another kind of warning is an indirect warning, sometimes called a weak warning. These are just like giving advice, yet they are advice about what not to do. You probably would only give such warnings to people you know. One of the most common ways we advise someone against doing something is with the phrase, "I wouldn't if I were you." Listen to an example.
"I wouldn't eat that if I were you. It's been sitting in the refrigerator for 2 weeks.
Some Americans leave out the if clause, "if I were you." Here is what that sounds like.
"I wouldn't eat that. It's been sitting in the refrigerator for 2 weeks.
I will say more about using if clauses in warnings shortly. Another phrase we use in advising about what not to do is, I don't think you should. Here is an example.
I don't think you should take off your mask. You might spread or catch the virus.
Again, keep in mind that a phrase like, I don't think you should, is something we would not use on strangers. Now let's talk about direct warnings, also known as strong warnings. One kind of direct warning tells someone that something bad will happen if he or she does or doesn't do something. For these, we usually use a conditional clause, also called an if clause, which expresses a condition. Listen to some examples.
If you go hiking alone, you will get lost.
I'm going to take your electronics away if you don't finish your schoolwork.
In both examples, the if clause appears on one side of the sentence. The result appears on the other side. Other strong warnings involve direct commands about not doing something. These often begin with the word don't. Take a listen.
Don't check your phone when crossing the street.
I'll be back in an hour. Don't answer the door for anyone.
Notice that the subject is missing from the start of both commands. You may remember that in English, the command form leaves out the subject. Keep in mind that some of these commands can be considered friendly advice, such as when we say, don't forget, like this.
Don't forget to bring water. You got thirsty the last time.
Another kind of warning is an explicit warning. We give these to prepare someone for an unpleasant experience. In explicit warnings, Americans usually use the word warning, saying things like, I'm warning you, or I must warn you. Depending on the situation, these can be friendly or they can be threats. Here is a friendly explicit warning.
Okay, we can do it that way, but just a word of warning. It will be much more difficult.
And finally, an example of an unfriendly threat.
I'm warning you, if you do that again, there will be problems.
Oh no, I don't like the sound of that. Hopefully you never hear that one being used. Well, that is our program for this week. But just one last warning. If you don't try the grammar exercise, you will miss a chance to practice your English. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Millard Fillmore, the 13th President of the United States. Fillmore is also likely the least remembered president. He has been called uninspiring and having only some competence. But Fillmore provided an example of the American dream come true. He rose from a poor family to become a wealthy man. He was elected to Congress four times and nominated for vice president under Zachary Taylor. When Taylor unexpectedly died in office in 1850, Fillmore took his place. Other presidents' campaigns, such as Andrew Jackson's, had spoken proudly of their candidates' modest beginnings. William Henry Harrison's supporters especially linked him with the image of a simple house called a log cabin, even though William Henry Harrison was a wealthy man. But Millard Fillmore really was born in a log cabin. His family was poor. They raised him and his seven brothers and sisters in a rural part of New York State. Fillmore did not receive much education as a child. However, he was very interested in learning, so interested that he fell in love with his teacher, Abigail Powers. The two married after he launched his career as a lawyer. They had two children, a son and a daughter. Millard Fillmore soon entered politics. He won elections to the New York State Assembly and then to the U.S. House of Representatives. After 8 years in Washington, D.C., Fillmore returned to New York. He failed to be elected governor, but succeeded to become comptroller of New York. In other words, he oversaw the state's finances. At that time, Americans were preparing for another presidential election. President James Polk was retiring from the White House after only one term, as he had promised. The opposition party, the Whigs, nominated Zachary Taylor as their presidential candidate. Taylor, a popular war hero from the South, owned slaves. But the Whigs realized that many anti-slavery voters in the North would not support Taylor. Party leaders were looking for someone to balance the ticket. A Northerner voters would consider a friend of business. They found Millard Fillmore. In 1847, the Whigs nominated Fillmore as Taylor's vice president. The two men had never met, and when they did meet, they did not like each other very much. Taylor was short-legged, poorly educated, and rarely seemed concerned about his physical appearance. Fillmore was taller, learned, and elegant. Their personalities did not fit together any better than their appearances did. But a majority of voters liked them. The Whigs won the election, and Fillmore returned to Washington. As vice president, Millard Fillmore was the leader of the Senate. But President Taylor did not seek his advice on the major political issue of the day. At the time, both lawmakers and the public were debating whether the government should, and could, ban slavery in the territories the U.S. had gained after the war with Mexico. In general, Northerners did not want to permit slavery in new states. But many Southerners did. The debate was so heated that one of the Southern states, South Carolina, threatened to leave the Union. President Taylor did not want to expand slavery. To restrict it, he proposed a change to the rules so California and New Mexico could enter the Union quickly as slave-free states. But before Taylor's idea could get too far, he became sick. Fillmore learned the president was not well and prepared for the worst. It came. Taylor died after being in office for only 16 months. The following day, Fillmore was sworn in as president. One of Fillmore's first acts as president was to show where he stood on the slavery issue. He appointed a man who opposed Taylor to Secretary of State. That man, Daniel Webster, and others, wanted to pass a compromise bill on slavery. With Fillmore's support, they succeeded. The Compromise of 1850 included several measures related to slavery. Two measures limited it. California was admitted as a free state, and the slave trade in Washington, D.C. ended. On the other hand, New Mexico and Utah were left open to slavery, and both the federal government and ordinary citizens were required to return suspected escaped slaves to their owners. That last measure, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, targeted even free African Americans and enslaved people who had escaped to free states. The compromise aimed to end the conflict between pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces. But neither side was really satisfied. And President Fillmore did not help matters. He was personally opposed to slavery. However, he did not act on his beliefs. Instead, he tried to keep the South in the Union by strongly enforcing the Fugitive Slave Act. By the end of Fillmore's 3 years in the White House, many members of his Whig Party were angry with him. Party leaders did not nominate him again for the next election. But their chosen candidate was not successful either. Fillmore turned out to be the last Whig president. The end of Fillmore's presidency included difficulty in his private life, too. His wife, Abigail, became sick on the day the next president was sworn in. She died within a month. Soon after, Fillmore's daughter died, too. To help deal with their loss, Fillmore tried to stay active in politics. In the presidential election of 1856, Fillmore served as the candidate for a new party, the Know-Nothing Party. The Know-Nothings were strongly opposed to immigration. They especially wanted to limit the number of Irish Catholics who could come to the United States. Fillmore did not agree with the party's anti-immigration policies, but he did not have a chance to put his opinions into policy. Fillmore finished third out of the three major candidates in the election. After that loss, he finally retired to the city of Buffalo, New York. There, Fillmore married a second time to a wealthy widow named Carolyn McIntosh. He remained an important figure in the city's charities and other causes. But the political situation in the country grew only more intense. Americans continued to be divided over the issue of slavery. Fillmore's time in office and his compromise bill may have delayed, but did not stop, the American Civil War. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.